Good morning. I'm your host, Claudia Shamba, welcoming you to the August 8th, 2023 edition of Ask a Leader. Today, Ohio is completing a special election that would raise the bar toward amending the Constitution, which has big ramifications for the fall election. So, as always, make sure your folks in Ohio turn out today. Now, for the program, we're not done with labor issues or January 6th. No, no, no. That and more are under examination in the latest Citric Acid Quarterly out this very month. Talking about that today for the full hour are my two guests, founding editor Andrew Tonkovich and contributor Anthony Pignataro. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the show. Here today are my two guests, founding editor Andrew Tonkovich and contributor Anthony Pignataro, bringing the fresh new issue of Citric Acid Quarterly, whose depth serves to put here in Orange County. It's their sixth issue, the Summer Solstice Edition. Anthony Pignataro, we're going to give a little bit of background. There's a lot more to say about, but this is what I have. He has been a journalist for 27 years. He learned how to report and write news stories at OC Weekly in its early days, then moved to Hawaii, where he edited Maui Time, the last alternative news weekly in the state, for 12 years. He returned to OC Weekly in 2019, just a few months before the paper closed. Today, he freelances for publications like Citric Acid and East Bay Magazine. He earned his bachelor's degree in political science from the University of California, Santa Barbara. And my other guest is Andrew Tonkovich. He's a retired lecturer in the UCI English department and served as president of the union there. He's edited the literary journal Santa Monica Review and was a feature writer for the OC Weekly and OC Register. He hosts Bibliocracy on Radio KPFK in Southern California. He later edited, along with his wife, Lisa Alvarez, Orange County, a Literary Field Guide. That's one of my shows back when they started. His fiction, nonfiction, and reviews have appeared in, among other places, the Los Angeles Times, Los Angeles Review of Books, Faultline, Ecotone, Zizova, and Best American Non-Required Reading. Andrew's penned two fiction collections, The Diary of Anne Frank and More Wish Fulfillment in the Noughties, and Keeping Tahoe Blue and Other Provocations. Andrew has published short stories, essays, and reviews in Ecotone, Faultline. And all of this, the heft of this literary skill and inquiry feed the very special platform that is Citric Acid. Andrew Tonkovich joins me in studio, and Anthony, I believe, you're over in Long Beach?
Yeah.
He joins us in Long Beach. Welcome to the show, Anthony Pignataro, and welcome back, Andrew Tonkovich.
Thanks, Claudia. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you so much. It's the Diary of Anne Frank. I don't want to be confused, although I would like to sell more copies of my book, but it's an intentional joke because the entire novella is based on student punctuation and spelling error. So.
And there it is. And I, fleeting as I zip through your bio, and I think I read that correctly. This is the first time. The more times I do it, the less accurate I get, unfortunately. Well, first, gentlemen, congratulations on keeping this lovely publication going and going strong. There's great stuff inside. As always, you bring to us what is happening right under our noses in time and in space. We can talk a bit in depth about your pieces, and then I'd like to see how many of the other submissions we can talk about, because there's so much here. So you've said in your press release that this is a theme is resistance meets resilience, and a few particular themes are going to be performance art and labor. Well, let's start, Anthony. with your article, quote, the title is Peasant Revolt, a dispatch from the medieval times picket line. The metaphors keep on giving in this piece, in this issue. Talk about this case study in redistribution of wealth.
Yes, certainly. Yeah, I mean, I hung out for a little while with the workers who were striking at Medieval Times in Buena Park. And for those who may not know, Medieval Times is it's kind of a dinner theater. It's a chain. There's locations all over the country where people sit down for, I think, something like $50 a head and eat like a chicken turkey dinner with their hands while watching actors portray knights in 11th century Spain running around and jumping off horses and dueling. And it's kind of a spectacular show. But late last year, the performers here in Buena Park voted to unionize.
And I just want to say, it's sort of the vibe here when you covered this in your wonderful article, Anthony. It's kind of like the patrons must be thinking this is a not-for-profit, anachronistic society exercise. You know, that cheap ticket they paid to get in isn't really doing enough to cover what true labor is valued.
Well, yeah. I mean, but again, this is, you know, there's still a lot of people in Orange County who don't think about those things. I mean, I certainly saw that in the picket line where, you know, workers would stand there with their signs, you know, basically in front of the entrance, you know, talking about things like unfair management, unfair wages, even horse abuse was a big reason for why they went on strike, why they wanted to unionize, why they wanted to, you know, ask for better working conditions. And people would just blow past them and as though, you know, what are you doing? Aaron Zapchik, one of the two strike captains who organized the strike, has been, you know, verbally abused repeatedly on the picket line, called all sorts of names, cursed. This has become what she's used to.
Wow. What to do with all of that? Because there's a mindset of the patrons. It's just they go back to the 11th century, literally. They're not just figurative about this and how they're sort of the boots on the neck of the workers there. And the beasts that are a part of the performance.
Sure, sure. And you know, that, I mean, Senators Robert Menendez and Cory Booker kind of used the term peasant revolt when they wrote a pretty vicious letter to Medieval Times corporate office, because another Medieval Times in New Jersey, where they're representing in the Senate, they also went on strike. They also they unionized. And they wrote, and they used the term, you know, you can't do these peasant revolts anymore. We don't allow that. This company has been taking the PPP loans during the pandemic, and yet now they're engaged in union busting. They won't really negotiate with the union. They have already been, they were on the verge of being sanctioned by the National Labor Relations Board. I believe the hearing is next month.
Okay.
Over charges that they unlawfully tried to steer workers away from unionizing back in November here in Buena Park. And these are serious allegations. That the National Labor Relations Board is basically, you know, saying you can't be doing this. And yet the company, I mean, no spokesperson ever got back to me when I reported the story. And I couldn't find an instance in other news outlets, Guardian, Los Angeles Times.
The Economist covered it, too.
Were able to talk to them.
Yeah. And I just want to sort of raise, like at 60,000-70,000 feet, hi, look at this. It's a Dallas-based Medieval Times that operates a total of 10 Castle Dinner Theaters located in Dallas, Atlanta, Baltimore, Chicago, Myrtle Beach, Orlando, Scottsdale, and Toronto. But the actual setting in Buena Park, does it, Anthony, have this kind of, we're like a mom and pop kind of local feel to it? And so people are just, they just have a different sort of relationship with the firm? the patrons?
No, it's like any other of the dinner theaters. I wouldn't characterize it that way.
Okay, because I've never been by there, but I definitely been reading around there. And I was just adding that even The Economist has been writing up about this, so it's getting a lot of attention. Is the strike, you said there's a hearing coming up next month, but the strike is still going on?
The strike is absolutely going on. We're at day 170, 180 something. I don't know that they keep real track of that anymore. I think they started to keep track of the days when they naively thought that it would last only a month. We're well past that now. The last I heard from Aaron was that there's a bargaining session next month, but nothing really has changed since they started, except the tone of the strike has changed. They've obviously, you know, they started out, it was kind of fun, because these are actors, these are performers, these are people who you know, they have a good time doing what they're doing. They just want to make sure that they're doing it under much safer conditions. They can get injured doing this. Some of these knights, these performers who portray knights, they can be badly injured jumping off of horses during the show and things like that. And they want safer working conditions, and they want more money. They want money commensurate with the kind of risk and skills required to do this kind of work.
And they've seen the writing on the wall with other of the locations of that Medieval Times is operating in, that there has been retribution against the organized employee.
Right. Well, I mean, they knew that going in. I mean, rather than sit down and negotiate and do a quick strike, the company opted to pay to fly in people to take over their jobs. And so that's costing the company a lot of money, but that's, they see that as a good alternative to simply having the union there. They would rather not have the union there in Buena Park.
So when these are, and I do want to know, I had Ada Briseño on last week, and the whole vibe about strikes in this summer of 2023 is that there is a kind of cumulative kind of power of many unions participating, striking right now. Is that a palpable element over in Buena Park?
Absolutely. In the last few weeks, they've had something like 40 members of the Writers Guild of America join the line with them in solidarity. And some of the Maui or some of the Medieval Times workers have gone and joined the WGA lines in Los Angeles. There's definitely this kind of solidarity that they're all in it together. That the SAG, the Screen Actors Guild, the WGA, and now you have a lot of hotel workers as
right.
well.
Unite Here, right. 11 was, yeah, exactly.
And there was talk, Virginia Parks of the University of California Irvine Labor Center told me that UPS workers in Southern California also could have gone on strike, but that was, I guess, averted in the last couple of weeks. But yeah, there's this general sense that there's a lot of labor action going on right now, and it's going to continue.
Okay, so Andrew is the founding editor. I don't know if you have something to say about this before we go on about your article about Peter Carr.
Oh, please, thanks, Claudia. I couldn't be more pleased to finally meet Anthony, as it were, on the phone, because he's a writer who
I
admired for a very long time. And
thank you. The feeling's mutual.
Yeah. So I'm quite proud that I actually found him, located him. We were both we both lost our gigs at the OC Weekly, which was murderized by the corporate goofballs and destroyed a really leading and groundbreaking and investigative reporting source. So if people don't know who Anthony is, he is the dude who so faithfully and in this incredibly disciplined way tracked the history of the effort to start the El Toro Airport. And he can riff on that if he wants.
We won't have a chance to do that, because that's a whole show. I want to do a whole retrospective with Anthony and other civic leaders.
I just want to call out his chops. And also, I'm very proud. You know, you have to go to Little Citric Acid to find the kind of in-depth political journalism right now around the Medieval Times strike, and it's because of Anthony. So thank you very much, Anthony.
Thank you.
It's a service to all of us. And we do keep going to that theme about covering what's sort of getting covered over. So, well, thank you for that. And I want to ask a little bit about the piece that you did, Andrew. It's a kind of an homage to a man that you said made, I'm going to get your quote. He was the activist and the artist that he was. He is responsible for making you the weirdo that you are today. But Peter had so many different things covered, and you bring the activism and the art and the commitment, and that is part of that, the resilience and resistance theme that you're weaving throughout this sixth edition of Citric Acid.
Yeah, thanks for that. I'm not sure where the resistance and the resilience are separated, and I kind of like the idea of some overkill there. This is indeed Union Summer today in Los Angeles. The members of SEIU are protesting for a better contract with the city of Los Angeles. So there's politics in the air, and one of my political inspirations many, many years ago was a kind of Orange County all-around character, a citizen of the kind of alternative and resistance politics that indeed made me the activist that I am today. And his name was Peter Carr, and he was the founder of the Comparative Literature Department at Cal State Long Beach. And to your point, Claudia, I started Citric Acid a year and a half ago for two reasons, and the OC Weekly is a through line here again. Number one, some pals from the OC Weekly, including my former editor, the great Gustavo Arellano, he and two of his colleagues came out with a book called A People's Guide to Orange County. And number two, I am dedicated to reminding people of the legacy of this former professor of mine, Peter Carr, who founded the Alliance for Survival, which was a grassroots anti-nuclear, anti-war outfit in Southern California, specifically in Orange County. So if it sounds like I'm repeating myself, it's because, again, these things are connected. And the fact that Anthony is someone that I could invite and who graciously accepted the offer to go to the picket line and document a story that's not getting the kind of coverage it should at the OC Register or at the Los Angeles Times, that's why Citric Acid exists.
And that's the theme here we're going to get to talk about. For those of you who just joined us, my guests are Anthony Pignataro and Andrew Tonkovich, contributor and founding editor, respectively, of Citric Acid, with their sixth issue now out. And with the time, let's see here. I guess there's a couple impressions I want to bring out. Is I want to read this issue. It's, for me, it feels like I'm spending a time in and take the metaphor, not totally literally, but figuratively. It's like spending all day long in a fully outfitted museum. I go in every single article is a gallery, and you're digesting so much work, so much intention by all those artists in that gallery. And that's what every article was like for me to read. And I'll go back and I can keep getting more and more, because it's you're covering different periods, different sorts of areas, and with all these really devoted wordsmithers and thinkers.
Well, thanks. I've now been in Orange County for 30 years. I've been in the literary community for even longer, and I've been lucky to meet so many terrific writers. So we have some of the most terrific local poets, prose writers, historians, journalists, photographers. Really, somebody should have started Citric Acid a long time ago, but I think it was the demise of the OC Weekly that showed me an opportunity, or maybe even a responsibility, to try to bring these folks together. I also was very, very happy to become a project of Santa Ana Building Healthy Communities, so that we have nonprofit status. I'm able to solicit donations, which then go back to paying a very, very modest honorarium to our contributors. Sorry about that, Anthony. Not
a few more zeros on that number.
Not getting paid what a professional investigative journalist should be getting. But, you know, it's a gesture, and it's a gesture toward community, finally.
And that is right. Let's go to those pieces now that the others have contributed. And I'm going to start local, and then we'll fan out. So you have in one piece is UCI professor emeritus and memoirist and University Hill's own Edward Fowler, who explores the enduring impact, or I call it the intergenerational dimensions, of Japanese-American internment in Orange County with visits to, among other sites, Tanaka Farm. So we don't have Ted here, but both of you can speak to what Ted contributed in the citric acid, this issue.
Sure. So this is a long-form piece, which I'm pleased arrives with artifacts and photographs. And Ted is really committed to a kind of revisionist history set in the local area. And he sort of goes on a road trip and unpacks the personal and familial stories of the children of the folks who were interred. Indeed, he makes a trip to Tanaka Farms, where I encourage people to go not only to check out their amazing produce, but because they've memorialized their family stories and the stories of the grandparents and, in some cases, parents who were sent to the camps ostensibly, you know, to protect the security of the United States, but of course, which Ronald Reagan, of all people, had to apologize for. Anthony's the investigative reporter. Maybe he wants to weigh in.
I apologize. I actually didn't read that story.
Oh, well, see, that's, folks, how much is there is in there. It's hard for everybody to cover everything all the time. Because you're covering your beat, and that's a big commitment to do that and follow every sort of weave and bob and weave of what's going on in medieval times. And you've got like other articles that you're building them right now as we speak. So, well, and the internment camps story is there's so many cultural traumatic dimensions to this that culturally there's this sort of a repressing of this horrible situation foisted at Japanese Americans, and you had Mitsui Yamada in an earlier edition, and there if people are keeping track, there's different kinds of nationalities. Mitsui was born in Japan, so her and her siblings were born here, but there's these different affiliations that were very complicated in the late in 1941 forward, and so it's. In Tanaka Farms, I don't know which they were all of the family members that were interned, were all born here is the sense I have.
Right.
Yeah. And but there's a kind of a Japanese American cultural thing about not necessarily being forthcoming about what you went through. And then there is a matter of who gets access to such a traumatizing kind of thing. It's, in a way, I don't take casually when I ask people about the trauma perpetrated on them, because I need to earn access to that. If I have been so removed from that, you know, it's, I'm putting that person through a great deal of work. So they're sorting out a lot of things, but they are coming. And if Ted were here, he could talk about how this is starting to, as it's been expressed to me by others, when an individual realizes their value as a relic in history, they are becoming more forthcoming about the trauma they went through.
Well, it's a complex circumstance in terms of how much to emphasize one's sort of victimization as opposed to celebrating the recovery of the past and going forward and becoming arguably more political, so that the witness that's offered at Tanaka Farms is a really sweet way, I think, of answering that question. And the road trip and the investigation and the long form kind of journalism and history that Ted does, I think, also answers some of your question.
And there, Poston, Arizona is the camp that's mainly talked about. There's a few pictures of Mazanar. And what's so interesting about those, most of those settings is that there has, everything's been removed. You can barely see foundations of the barracks in some of those. And I saw Topaz Mountain outside of Salt Lake City, and it, you can't, there is nearly nothing. It's nothing left there. So that is a remarkable piece. Now, I want to move to Lisa Alvarez's piece, Where Do We Go From Here? And Anthony, please tell me you did read that one.
Which one was it about?
Lisa Alvarez's piece about Alan Hostetter. You must have read that one.
Oh, yeah.
Okay,
oh, yeah.
So be ready with some commentary here. So I have, she's curated, she's taken 15 questions out of 46 pages of questions Alan Hostetter uses as his own defending attorney as a January 6th defendant in USA versus Hostetter. And he was found guilty last month of four felonies, including obstruction of Congress, and he will be sentenced in October. And I want to open with my impression of how Lisa Alvarez curated this piece. The question, it's just his questions. She lifts them, puts them in here. It's like a kind of forensic job. It's like she's opening up his cranium, the cranium of a conspiracy theory stoker. And she, you can sort of look inside and see what all of these conspiracy theory bonkers themes are going on in his head. It's wild.
It is. And if folks don't know the story, the former police chief of La Habra left his job to become a yoga instructor.
And that's, I want that to be an article in Citric Acid, because I finally saw I saw a picture of him being sworn in as a La Brea police chief, and then you cut to La Habra, oh, that too, and then a picture of him when he was at all the Board of Supervisors meetings in his new attire to see them. So something, that is a Citric Acid article, is what happened there. But let's go back to you were saying.
Well, Orange County is the gift that keeps on giving. And I mean that in both my most ironic and facetious way, but also in kind of a loving way, because in some sense we're the hellmouth for a whole lot of leftover evil that comes out of a reactionary past, the kind of thing that still goes on at medieval times, but that also, I think, is being addressed and being responded to, maybe in this case with some humor and with some perspective. And except for the Board of Supervisors and a couple of the local elected officials, the county has gone largely Democrat, so that we are this kind of Trump country hellmouth where it's possible for one of these kind of new age yoga people to drift into the conspiracy world, the culture of the bizarre, and yet at the same time for us to see his conviction, along with, I think it's at least 1,000 participants in January 6th.
So growing.
So Hostetter and his wife were both folks who
she was a fourth grade San Clemente educator.
Yeah. I mean, you can't make this stuff up, except, you know, here it is. It's Orange County. It's, in a way, it's kind of a too easy target. And I don't want to overstate the clownishness of somebody who, I would argue, has, you know, gone off the deep end, and unfortunately kind of works as a stand-in for an entire sort of pathology that has now completely taken over the Republican Party, including the Orange County Republican Party and the state Republican Party, which, you know, just gave all its members you know, no choice but to support Trump. So, I mean, I feel sorry in a way for Hostetter. I think Lisa did a public service by, again, as you say, kind of curating the best of or the worst of the sort of strange, illogical rant that has become basically the party platform of the GOP.
A rant, though, that he says with such a straight face in all the rallies that he attends. But I want to bring Anthony in on this, too, is with both of your long view, 60,000 foot sort of flight over how these patterns are emerging. Because of what Andrew was just talking about, the sort of political dynamics in Orange County, when by about 7:15 p.m. on January 6th, weren't both of you wondering who the heck was writing checks out of Orange County to make this happen? Because I don't want to tamper the witnesses here. So were you both starting to think because we'd already seen those checks were being written for some other sort of local kind of rally activity. But so were you thinking about that, Anthony, by the end of the evening of January 6th, 2021?
Oh, sure. And it's because Orange County itself was home for so long and still is to this kind of entitled white guy feeling that, you know, I run the country. The country was built for me and I'm in charge. And Orange and the country's not like that anymore. And Orange County is not like that anymore. And it's not ever going to be like that again. So you have people like Hofstetter who still want to be in charge. They still want to be unquestioned. I mean, reading through Lisa's story with his questions, I got this feeling of entitlement, that he is entitled to everything. He's masquerading his own manifesto as curiosity when it's not. He's not a curious man because he's got all the answers, and everybody else. This is kind of a tactic on the far right wing to say, well, I'm just asking questions, and it's like, well, you're not asking questions. You already know, you already believe, and no one's going to change your mind. And the more Orange County moves into the blue category, it's not really there yet. It's kind of purple still, because you have places like San Clemente, you have places like Galesa or Newport Beach, Huntington Beach is changing, and as you go through this, you're going to see more of these kind of reactionary moments where it's almost like a tantrum, and in many ways, that's what January 6th was. So it didn't surprise me at all that somebody like Hofstetter was in the middle of it.
Well, yeah, and I mean, we saw the Minutemen and other kinds of things getting underwritten here. But I was curious about whether you two had let your minds wander. And I actually, to the discrediting of people who consider themselves scholars, within that week, I was asking around, who do you think was underwriting a lot of the activities? Because it was an expensive operation, as we were now seeing. There were a lot of checks that were written. But I don't know if the two of you, if you raised it, if you got the same reaction I did. People didn't want to go there with me. And I asked them, who do you think helped underwrite it? And they wanted to go back to their projects. Oh, I'm writing this book about Madison. I'm writing this book about that and that. So people weren't, I don't think they, maybe they were too traumatized to think about where the support coming from. Andrew's got a furrowed brow here.
It's a permanent condition, Claudia. Thanks for noticing. But sometimes it arrives with a smile. So I'll just do a shout out to Tom Zellner, who in a previous issue, he located John Eastman very early as, of course, this phony legal architect of this nonsense. And of course, now Eastman is widely understood to be one of the five unindicted conspirators, the former law professor at Chapman University and at Pepperdine, and somebody who you might have imagined was a kind of moderate or reasonable Republican, but went full on Trump. But here's the good part of the story, Claudia, and I think to Anthony's point, it is not the Orange County of 20, 30, 40 years ago. It's still the sort of leftover, and there's a lot of these pockets. There's a lot of money.
Deep pockets.
Yeah,
here.
And to your point, you know, Trump's going to come here and beat the bushes for money
at the
again.
End of September. I've got press credentials coming.
Oh, good. I'm glad you'll be there, Claudia. So, but I mean, here's the good part. So in a previous edition of the magazine, I'm very proud to say, Tom Zellner, who's an award-winning, renowned nonfiction writer and who teaches at Chapman, he not only collected support among his colleagues at this tiny liberal arts private university with a very conservative tradition to object to the university's continuing association with Chapman. But as a result of his organizing, he actually founded the first ever chapter of the American Association of University Presidents, AAUP, of which I am a proud member, at this tiny school, which I have to say is more than ever happened at UC Irvine, where I struggled to form a chapter. So, you know, that's maybe the resistance and resilience through line that citric acid is all about.
So thank you for that. This is to entice people to pick up the copy of this recent issue, and you can see Lisa Alvarez. She gives you 15. She's curated 15 of Alan Hostetter's questions, which are part of his defense. And then you've got the hyperlink. You can go to all 46 pages of what he has to say. It's a wild ride. So let's give, there's several other pieces I want to talk about too. And to the point of where things are sort of getting covered up, erased, and then resurface is Mapping Santa Ana Art and Activism. And I don't know what his name thing is for here. Roger Eyes R and Sarah Rafael Garcia. Sarah was on this show when citric acid first was released, and they literally put facts that have been erased back on the ground, starting with the Logan Barrio as an example. So both of you could comment on what they're trying to do with missing the Mapping Santa Ana and Art.
Yeah, one of the projects of citric acid is to promote already existing cultural and political institutions and campaigns. And Sarah is a role model and an inspiration to so many people. She's the founder of Libromobile and Creer Studios. And so she has worked in collaboration with an artist to produce an ongoing dynamic map, which illustrates, uncovers, and celebrates as a sort of revisionist history project, bringing information, history, and I'll just say it, pride to the story of Santa Ana, and which tells the stories that people need to know. And we chose to highlight just two of them. But if you go online, you can explore the entire project thus far. So Roger does the graphics and Sarah does the text and kind of curates the whole deal. And you can spend hours there learning about the hidden history of Santa Ana. I'm very proud, again, that citric acid has worked with Sarah and with other institutions, with scholars, with activists, because this is not about trying to create something new. It's just about trying to put together and, you might say, aggregate the work of so many amazing writers and activists and scholars who are in Orange County working, writing about Orange County, including, you know, my former boss, the terrific Gustavo Arellano, Nick Scow, also from the OC Weekly, Anthony Pignataro, Gabriel San Ramon. These are all folks who I am so pleased got on board with me after the beloved OC Weekly was, you know, again, taken apart and had served as such a vital source for, again, making news, making community, and doing the kind of deep dive around things like the history of the Klan in Orange County, Anthony's reporting on the defeat of the airport, on uncovering parts of the county that folks didn't know about, on. And that's one thing that Roger and Sarah do so beautifully in this section.
And Anthony, I tell you, I really do want to have a whole show on all the work about the El Toro-based conversion to what we have now. That I don't ever want to give that short shrift. And all of those things are big, but that's one. And it keeps coming up in several of the most recent city council in Irvine meetings, where there's actually been like an oral history where things are sort of rolled back and this is where we were. So we will do that show when you get a chance. So then
sure.
One, this is not a spoiler. It's just to tell you all how much is inside. Rhoda Huffy's piece on Costa Mesa. It's very cinematic. I don't know if that's one reason why he picked it, but she puts in her, in the introduction to her article, she says,
it's a short story.
It's a short story. Thank you. Costa Mesa has the most small businesses per capita of any town in the U.S. Wow.
Well, I think that maybe that's part of building a very convincing and sometimes funny portrayal of what it was like for this character to live in Costa Mesa. Rhoda Huffy is an acclaimed novelist who came out of, many years ago, the University of California Irvine MFA program. She's published two novels and all kinds of short stories. And again, citric acid, you know, we're punching way above our weight. So I'm grateful for the writers who might have contributed work to places with a lot bigger profile and a lot bigger readership, but who gave me their beautiful art, their writing, their reportage, because they believe in the project and they have some connection to Orange County. So Rhoda herself lived in Costa Mesa. Costa Mesa is a setting in her most current book, 31 Paradiso, and also her previous book, The Hallelujah Side. And I'm really grateful. And the other short fiction in here is from a Chapman University professor who is a gorgeous creative writer and who sets his piece way up on the top of San Diego Peak, the so-called Saddleback. So we've got it all in this issue, from the mountain to the sea and all the territory in between, whether it's geographic territory, political territory, poetry, arts, and history. And it's just for me, it's exciting to reach out to people, to discover new folks. I really welcome suggestions, and I'm always looking for writers who want to contribute to this sort of telling or retelling of the story of Orange County.
Anthony.
Yeah.
You can talk to that too. Punching over the above the weight and bringing all these details that people have just are totally oblivious to, and why you like doing this.
Well, this is what I was taught to do. I mean, when I started at OC Weekly, I was 23 years old, just out of college, and it wasn't a newspaper like any other newspaper I had seen, and the purpose of it wasn't to do daily updates on robberies or murders or things like that. It was to illuminate Orange County as a place and show what made the county work, why things happened here, and why it was unique in itself. It wasn't just a bunch of suburbs loosely connected next to Los Angeles. It wasn't just where Disneyland was. It was its own place with its own history and people. And that's what we set out to do, and that's what we did for its entire length of run. And that's why I like writing for Citric Acid now, because it's doing the same thing.
Yeah, we were really lucky, weren't we, Anthony, that we happened to fall into the alt weekly cultural moment, and that there was a kind of a visionary guy who had some money to start up one in Orange County, of all places. My first ever, you might not know this, Anthony, my first ever paying gig was for the LA Weekly, which published a small poem of mine when I was also in my early 20s, and made me feel, correctly or not, that writing was worthwhile, that civic engagement, that art was meaningful. And whether I'm delusional or on some kind of quixotic voyage, but that's just defined my whole life, and it sounds like it's defined yours as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've written about so many different things about Orange County that just weren't written about anywhere else. And it wasn't just the airport. It was writing about little tiny protests. Like, my very first story for OC Weekly ever was about people who took tree branches and crafted them into a deer when they were building the 73 toll road. And it was their way of silently protesting the making of this toll road, which had just opened or was about to open when OC Weekly started. And It was stuff like that. It was looking at people who were doing things like that that weren't traditionally falling into the realm of normal journalism. Their stories otherwise were rarely told. And this was what got me interested in it, and this is the kind of writing that I've always been energized by. And I think people like to read this.
So many lovely pieces that talk to that point. It's as I meant that fully when I said they're right here in Orange County, that each one we can maybe one more article of submission that we can talk about. I want to bring up, there is the Linda Thomas.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. Linda Thomas is one of my favorite people. She's a retired English instructor at Irvine Valley College, but in her other life, she is a published poet, and she is a birder and a naturalist. And again, to your earlier point and your shout out, for which I'm really grateful, Claudia, is I have the opportunity to be as eclectic, as inclusive, as out there as I like as editor of this journal. So the tone shifts, the ambitions shift. Here's a piece that's a short meditation on morality, on aging, on birth and death, as told by somebody who wakes up every morning in Orange County as a poet, as a photographer, as a docent, as a birder, as an expert on the natural world, and composes just this gorgeous piece on kind of juxtaposing the life cycle of the natural world with the life cycle of the human world, which, you know, we have to confront aging and mortality. And she does it by way of tracking the birds that she sees in our own region. It's gorgeous, with photographs that she takes herself.
And I just, to that point, I lifted out one little quote that will really stay with me from Linda Thomas. Quote, "I imagine the man in the camp chair thought himself a sort of hawk whisperer, but the truth is, he is simply a part of the daily intrusion that all birds endure from us humans." End of quote.
That's wonderful, isn't it? And that's spoken with the kind of the protective embrace, or the understanding of how a birder, somebody who apprehends the habits and the rituals and the life cycle of the natural world, sees maybe the folks who only dip into it occasionally. It's also a very, I would say, affirming piece and an invitation to be like Linda, which is to get up in the morning and go out and apprehend the natural world, which, despite all the intrusions from the toll road and the development, all the rest, Orange County is still one of the most beautiful places to encounter, whether it's the hills or the beaches or the parks or the forests. And that's one reason to be here.
And Peking does that.
Oh,
Peking,
right.
Does that exactly.
Yes, the other short story, which I have to say, people should go right away and maybe read that one right off. It's a very compelling story
about
the kind of final moments of what might be reconciliation or might be abandonment.
No spoiling. We want people to read this.
Yeah, but I mean, Morgan Reed Davidson just writes a very traditional story, but then which turns into a kind of remarkable character study with an element of danger and apprehension and some real challenge. And it all takes place on that remarkable hike. I hope some people have done it, all the way to the top of Santiago Peak.
Completely as edgy as the articles inside the Dad's Shaving Kit. There, no spoiling. I'm just enticing you all.
Thank you.
Did you read that one, Anthony?
I did.
You okay? Well, I want to thank you both. I'm just trying to, I have one sort of suggestion, a proposal, a modest proposal, is that there's no place for readers to comment like a salon to each other. I don't think I noticed that. I looked around. And the Bird app isn't doing much posting. The Bird app postings are kind of rare, but I checked that. So you're invariably, though, creating, and you're building a community that needs to chew on this material in a collective. And I want to suggest Citric Avid. would be your salon chatting room.
Oh, thanks very much. So I'm learning a lot. Let's give. I'm happy to cop to some humility here, but I am proud to say that in the last few weeks, and a shout out to Anthony as well, is we've become much more engaged with our Instagram account. So that's one place where people can share. And I'm going to try to get Claudia to take a picture with me here in the studio, and we'll be able to celebrate today's show. Indeed, subscribers free of charge can sign up at the website so that you will be alerted to events, the forthcoming issue, a live launch party that we'll be doing in September, on and on. It's a place that we'll be sharing more. It's also possible to make a donation to support the nonprofit work of Citric Acid. And but thanks for being a booster, Claudia. I love the Citric Avid tag, and maybe somebody will be able to run with that. The next issue will be out in late September, and I'm very proud to say that I've already been given very generously a piece by Anthony, which is a kind of a personal meditation on a very important Orange County landmark. I'll leave it there and hope that folks will look for his writing, along with that writing of many other poets and journalists and fiction writers, in the next issue of Citric Acid.
Okay, and I'm going to suggest the proper etiquette for reading and sharing these is read, marvel, donate, and repeat. Thank you, Anthony and Andrew, for your time. This has been such a pleasure.
Thank you, Claudia. It's been a pleasure as well.
My guests were Anthony Pignataro and Andrew Tonkovich, contributor and founding editor, respectively, of Citric Acid, with their sixth issue now out. Citric Acid, Inc. for all the details. And I just want to announce that the training program for KUCI's summer quarter is officially beginning this Thursday. That's August 10th, 7 p.m. in Steinhaus Hall, room 134. The directions, if you want to check out the campus map, it's building 502. Well, that's my wrap. Next week, my guest is Doug Resser, who break down how Irvine mounted the near top of the list of California cities' first year of home ownership costs. Talk with you next week. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Santa Ana summertime, Santa Ana summertime. Like it or not, them things go pop. The hood stay active and flooded with cops, and all the knuckleheads still mobbing the street. Santa Ana stay hot like that.